What threat does the Trump presidency pose to elite corporate elements within the United States? What are the real reasons Trump's cabinet picks are under scrutiny for their past conversations with Russian officials? Should Canadians be heartened or concerned by the Trudeau government's cordial engagement with the newly elected president last month? What is the mainstream media failing to adequately convey in its news coverage of the Trump administration's reporting on this week's speech to Congress? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we continue examining the Trump presidency and the ways in which elite authorities are positioning themselves to confront the Trump administration 6 weeks after the president's inauguration and days after his first speech to Congress. We'll speak with outspoken author, analyst, and retired Binghamton University Emeritus Professor James Petras. We'll hear from Vancouver-based writer and newcoldwar.org editor Roger Annis. And we'll hear from Toronto-based media analyst Barry Zwicker. On this week's program, Trump and the Deep State, Part 3, Investigating Russia, Détente with Canada, and the Speech to Congress. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 3rd, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. His Tuesday address was long on making America safe for Wall Street, war profiteers, and other corporate predators, short on what's most needed to serve all Americans equitably and promote world peace. He focused on increased military spending at a time major cuts are needed, combating terrorism without explaining ISIS and like-minded groups are U.S. creations used as imperial foot soldiers. He called for repealing and replacing Obamacare, omitting what he and GOP lawmakers want is something worse, maybe devastating for the nation's most vulnerable. "We will soon begin the construction of a great wall along our southern border," he said. He lied, claiming it'll deter illicit drugs and crime. That comes from the article, "Trump's Address to the U.S. Congress, Making America Safe for Wall Street and War Profiteers," by Stephen Lentman, posted March 2nd. This was reality television made flesh, the grandest show. Congress turned into more than a mere Will Rogers comedy set. It was a show topped by the grieving widow, Karen Owens, wife of Chief Petty Officer William Ryan Owens, a Navy SEAL who fell in Trump's authorized raid in Yemen. Quote, "Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation," unquote. Mythology and the military-industrial complex as one. Illusions united. That comes from the article, "Trump's Joint Address, The Reality Show Comes to U.S. Congress," by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted March 2nd. There is no point taking piecemeal measures or organizing one-off events, no matter how big, to express your concern. If you don't plan, organize, and act strategically, you will have wasted your time and effort on something that has no impact. Remember the 15th of February 2003? Up to 30 million people in over 600 cities around the world participated in rallies against the war on Iraq in what some labeled the largest protest event in human history. Did it stop the war? That comes from the article, "Resisting Donald Trump's Violence Strategically," by Robert J. Burroughs, posted March 2nd. Syrian-American Sarah Abed was born in Al-Kamishli and has lived in both the USA and Syria throughout her life. She makes frequent trips back and forth. Sarah is in direct daily contact with family and friends that reside in different parts of Syria. Sarah conducted and translated an interview with a close friend, Samir, who lives in Syria and is well informed about the conditions on the ground. Samir's commentaries are consistent with President Assad's assessment of the imperialists' strategy of divide and conquer. That comes from the article, Syria, the Criminal Empire's Strategy of Divide, Conquer, and Destroy, part one of a series by Mark Taliano and Sarah Abed, posted March 2nd. The White Helmets continues to play a leading role in the Western cyber warfare as a weapon which is used against the legitimate government of Syria. Due to a great number of fake photos and videos in the social networks picturing rescuers who risk their lives to save civilians caught in the country's devastating war, the Western audience receives a distorted picture of the military situation in Syria. Western TV channels, including Pan-Arabic Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, promote White Helmets as the only humanitarian organization which is allegedly engaged in rescuing Syrians. At the same time, in their coverage, they have never mentioned the actual efforts of the Syrian government and its allies for the sake of settlement of the crisis and supplying the affected population with humanitarian aid. It seems that the winner of the Best Documentary Short was decided long before the ceremony, with powerful figures with a finger in a pie of the jury's final decision. That comes from the article, The Deception Technology, Hollywood Oscar for Fake Movie, by Firas Samouri, posted March 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Six weeks have elapsed since the inauguration of Donald Trump, and the assault on his administration seems to continue unabated. The biggest hit on Trump's presidency remains the allegation that Russian government sources are interfering with the integrity of U.S. democracy. In December, the FBI officially accused Russia of interfering in the U.S. election in order to assist the Republican candidate. This on the same day outgoing President Obama accused the Russian president of knowing about the hacks. 2 weeks later, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI released a joint report detailing Russian hacking of the DNC's computer network, resulting in Washington announcing a new round of sanctions against Russia and the expulsion of 35 Russian diplomats. In mid-January, a CIA dossier emerged containing salacious and unverified information that Trump had been cavorting with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel room and that Russian intelligence had filmed the encounter, making the billionaire susceptible to blackmail at a later date. Then in mid-February, Trump's pick for National Security Advisor Michael Flynn resigned in the wake of suggestions he had supposedly misled Vice President Pence on the extent of his communications with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Now, on March 2nd, the day before this episode goes to air, Trump's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, announced that he will recuse himself from any investigations into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. This on the grounds that he had not disclosed to Congress two meetings last year with the Russian ambassador. In tandem with officialdom's questioning of Trump's fitness to govern, popular mobilizations, mostly focused on Trump's hostility towards Muslims, migrants, and women, have dogged him since Inauguration Day. Joining us to discuss the Trump presidency and the apparent effort to attack his foreign policy, if not remove him from the Oval Office, is James Petras. James Petras is a retired Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, and is also a adjunct professor at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Petras.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, now, I know that there are a lot of legitimate grievances that many Americans and people around the world have toward the Trump administration, but there does seem to be a serious effort to destabilize his presidency, if not remove him entirely. And I find myself, I'm reminded a little bit of the lead up to the war in Iraq, where they seem to be going from one pretext to another, you know, links with 9/11 and human rights violations and so on, until eventually settling on the narrative of weapons of mass destruction. And right now, what I'm looking with the apparent efforts to destabilize the Trump presidency from higher up elements. I mean, they seem to be looking at Islamophobia and misogyny and whatnot. But it seems like the one that seems to be sticking and doubling down on is this effort to link him with as being some sort of a Russian agent, and that there's some sort of some kind of duplicity there. And so we've seen General Flynn has been removed because of his conversations, as well as now just today we're hearing about Jeff Sessions and his communications that seem to be, we're seeing him being set up for some sort of a fall. So I'm wondering what you are reading into this this Russia narrative is somehow the cudgel that's being used to beat Trump.
I think the main thing to look at here is the introduction by Trump as a new kind of imperialism, and his original strategy was essentially to eschew military types of intervention, wars, and attempts to encircle Russia, and ultimately destroy it. I think the Obama administration and its predecessors were intent on reverting Russia back into the 1990s to the 2000 mark, overthrow Putin and establish a kind of unilateral power of the United States over the world economy, world military, and insofar as Trump was pursuing a policy which looked toward reconciliation and developing favorable trade terms with Russia as part of a general strategy of improving U.S. exports on a world scale, cutting back on imports and renegotiating with China its trade agreements, and the Trans-Pacific he dumped because he thought this was further undermining the U.S. export position and was becoming essentially an importing comprador kind of capitalism. And so the fact that Trump made some gestures which were completely harmless of discussing with the Russian ambassador before the inauguration is a phony pretext. It was essentially to knock out one of Trump's key operatives in this new paradigm that I mentioned of promoting market imperialism as opposed to military imperialism. I think that's the key to the whole strategy. And essentially, it's a strategy first undermining Trump's promoter, Flynn, and continuing on purging whatever officials are in the Trump administration, in his cabinet, and eventually overthrowing Trump through some phony charges once they've disarmed and disarticulated his program. Hmm. Trump wants a market relationship. He wants to increase U.S. Competitiveness. He wants to increase the power of the working class in order to have a kind of social imperialism, strong at home in order to dominate overseas markets. He's not interested. He wasn't interested primarily in military occupations, particularly of countries that he thought either the U.S. could dominate economically or were not significant to his general overview. So I think to answer on the short run your immediate question, yes, they want to overthrow Trump because they're opposed to his imperial strategy. This is very serious business because it's a division between two sets of oligarchies. The market oligarchy, the exporters, the working class, the attempts to further U.S. investments and return the profits back into the United States, as opposed to previous administrations, the Democrats, the liberals, the neoliberals, the neoecons. Their policy essentially is driven by a military imperialism that seeks to dominate and occupy countries of existence. And they've totally failed. Their military ventures are leading to prolonged wars. Their budgets were totally out of whack. $1 trillion trade deficits between the Asian countries and the United States, of which Taiwan, Singapore, and South Korea are a percentage of the GNP that comes from U.S. exports far exceeds China. So this is a historical problem and an attempt by Trump to rectify this damaging approach to imperialism and undermining through low wages the social underpinnings for economic imperialism.
I've got a question because you had a previous article you alluded to these efforts against Trump as a CIA regime change operation coming home.
Well, it's not just the CIA. The state apparatus that Trump inherited, one of his strategic errors, was not taking on and changing the structures of this the permanent state apparatus, what some people call the state silent state apparatus. But I think that's part of it. It's also the mass media. It's also the ideologues. It's also the importers, especially the large commercial places that depend on cheap imports and cheap labor. And these were the forces that are allied against Trump, not to speak of the entire Democratic Party, especially its liberal and neocon versions. And I think this is what is at stake. We have rival imperial oligarchs fighting it out, and I think so far Trump has been losing as they peel away his supporters, and Sessions is even more preposterous. As a head of the Armed Services Committee, he had every right to open a dialogue with Russian diplomatic people. He spoke to 25 deputy ambassadors and Russian foreign policy, among others, but 25 officials of state, foreign states. Suddenly, out of the hat, they pick his meetings with the Russians. This is a phony as a $3 bill.
But at the same time, I mean, there are some things that that Mr. Trump is proposing that does seem to be favorable, at least to within the Republican Party. You know, the tax cuts and the fewer regulations.
Yes, that's
less,
true.
And the whole, you know,
what we're going to get ultimately, short of the overthrow of Trump, is the worst features of the neocon Democrats and the worst features of Trump's pro-business position, we're going to get the war policies abroad and the tax cuts domestically, which means lower living standards because Trump will not have the opportunity of imposing market capitalism, which could possibly increase the flow of profits and investments back into the United States.
Well, just going back to, you know, the kind of the parallels with regime change operations in Latin America and abroad, I think there's always been some sense where you might have certain leaders that might be given a bit of a leeway, given a chance, but eventually they say, this isn't going to work. You know, whether it was, you know, Aristide or Chavez or whoever, and they make the decision to pull the plug. Is it possible that Trump might be allowed to retain his office as long as he changes tack on some of
the... Well, that's what they're doing now. Now, it's incremental coupism, if you want. It's first strip him of power, undermine his program, and then create conditions that make him extremely vulnerable. He'll lose his support among workers. His inability to implement an effective growth policy is going to cause a stock crash. He'll be very vulnerable to being ousted.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and we have like the Vice President Mike Pence and the Mad Dog Mattis, as he's called, and these other figures in the administration. I mean, should Trump be removed, it would seem that you're not going to have any resistance to that that neocon design.
Pence may come to power, but he'll be simply a tool of the power structure that replaces Trump.
Mm-hmm. But so essentially, just getting rid of the whatever assistance. So that, like, you.
Trump has had a strategy. Trump had a paradigm for revising and upgrading U.S. imperialism around a totally different direction than what preceded it. He wasn't engaged in a worldwide effort to realign U.S. against Russia. He didn't have a strategy of militarily encircling China. What he wanted by throwing out the Trans-Pacific was to begin bilateral negotiations to get better economic terms. Obama was trying to provoke wars in the South Pacific. He was setting up bases. He was sacrificing U.S. trade advantages in order to build up allies to attack China. Trump is not into that. He's into renegotiating trade terms with China and the rest of Asia and using whatever muscle he has militarily to leverage that renegotiations.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are mobilizations, popular mobilizations against Trump, and I'm sure you would agree that most of those people who are mobilizing in the streets and so on are not necessarily on the same page as the these elite figures that are seeking to overthrow.
Well, a lot of them are being used. Don't forget, George Soros is financing a lot of these NGOs. You get a lot of people that are somehow employed in one form or another in the public sector, which is facing cuts as part of Trump's pro-capitalist policies. You have feminist movements that represent particularly middle class, lower middle class, and upper class women who are not facing the economic pressure opportunities that Trump outlines, but face, in fact, some threats. And, of course, the symbolism of Trump's attitude that has been magnified by the media, some of his talks about sexual policies toward women, the sexual harassment, et cetera, things that happened 10 and 20 years ago. Again, this is magna politics, magnifying the past in order to maximize political advantage in the short run. There are many people at protest that should have protested against Obama. Don't forget, Obama expelled 2.5 million immigrants, breaking down doors, seizing people from factories, etc. And these people that are protesting never raised a finger against the forced seizure and expulsion of 2.5 million Latinos and Central Americans and others.
Well, what do you say to this argument that, be that as it may, those elite factions, the fact is that you have a Republican in power now, and like the anti-war movement and all these social justice movements, which seem to be asleep under Obama, maybe now they could in some sense align themselves with these deep state elements, you know, like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Is there a danger in that?
Absolutely a danger, because the Democrats are going to squeeze, and then they're going to toss him like a used condom. There's no history of Obama fighting for higher wages. There's no history of Obama fighting for even a simple issue like easing the vote for unionization. There were many assassinations and abuse of blacks during Obama's presidency, the difference between black workers and white workers increased, the inequalities increased during Obama, the $1 trillion subsidies for the big bailouts of the banks far exceeded the 2.5 million mortgage holders who lost their home. I mean, this was a totally reactionary regime in every sense of the word, from seven wars to pro-banker, pro-war policies. And I think we have to put that in perspective. And the challenge that Trump represented by his turn toward market imperialism was a very profound a challenge to that whole operations, and I think that's why they're going for the throat.
Just one last question, and I'll let you go. Is there an opportunity for the working class and all these other marginalized peoples to benefit from this situation that doesn't necessarily advance the prospects either of Trump or the neocons
I think the overthrow of Trump will deepen the reaction, deepen the alienation of workers to Washington. I think the possibilities of greater militancy would have to wait until a new leadership emerges. As it is, the bulk of the trade union bureaucracy is totally aligned with the Democrats, who are in turn in bed with Wall Street and military imperialism. I think there is virtually no possibility of an alternative to the Democrats on the horizon now. And I think I'm afraid that this period of overthrowing or decimating Trump is simply going to make things worse and undermine whatever trade union access they had to power.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us and sharing
your
thoughts.
Okay, very
with
good.
Us.
Thanks for inviting me.
We've been speaking with Professor James Petras. He's retired Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. He's also a widely sought commentator and a regular contributor to the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Canada's federal government has had to adjust to the reality of the new Trump administration. So far, the leaders of the two neighboring countries appeared at ease and even friendly with each other when they met in Washington, D.C. in mid-February. However, appearances can sometimes be deceiving. The Trudeau government is vocally supportive of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which the U.S. president has vowed to renegotiate. Trump's rhetoric against migrants from Mexico and Muslims runs afoul of Canada's advocacy for openness on the world stage. Trump's past misogynistic behavior sparked demonstrations on the day after his inauguration, as opposed to the feminist background of the Trudeau. And what's more, Trump himself has consistently argued for more congenial relations with the Russian government, while his predecessor and rivals for the presidency, much of the Western press, and even Canadian officials have consistently expressed hostility to perceived Russian aggression in Crimea and elsewhere, warranting sanctions and military mobilizations. To discuss what the Trump presidency means for Canadian foreign policy, we're joined by another past guest. Roger Annis is a socialist, a trade union activist, and a retired aerospace worker based in Vancouver. He writes regularly on topics of war and social justice and is an editor and regular contributor to newcoldwar.org. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Roger.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Roger, you wrote an article declaring that corporate Canada breathed a sigh of relief following Trudeau's visit to Washington, suggesting that maintaining Canada's business relationship with the U.S. was being given a higher priority than the progressive social and environmental priorities of most Canadians. Are there any concrete concessions that Trudeau has made in the interests of kowtowing to business elites in both countries?
Yes, I think there is. Really, the Canadian government and other governments in the world that claim or pretend to be liberal are a little bit off balance by the election of Trump in the United States. It's clearly a departure from their way of looking at the world and governing the world, as a departure from the Obama administration that preceded it. But if you look at the outcome of the Trudeau visit to Washington in mid-February, and also when you start to look at the specific policy issues, and I'm thinking particularly as concerns foreign policy and also as concerns North American energy, or shall we say resource plunder policy, there's a terrific synchronism there. And so I think it's no accident that the Canadian government and the Canadian business elite finished the Trudeau's visit to Washington with what I said was a sigh of relief. It went well, and Trump himself went out of his way to declare that Canada is, if not the closest ally of the United States, then one of the closest allies. And of course, that's true and been very true for decades. So they are unsettled because there's uncertainty about all this, in the same way that many of the business elite in the United States are settled, rather unsettled. But are we going to see, deep friction between the two governments, deep divergences in policy? Frankly, I don't think so. We already see a lot of similarity, and I think to the extent that there's disagreement, for example, the stated positions on immigration, I think we're going to see the Canadian government simply adapt itself to the U.S. government. And indeed, in today's Globe and Mail is an article by Reuters explaining that there are extensive talks going on right now between the U.S. and government, U.S. and Canadian governments, to bring Canadian immigration policy into line with this outrageous conduct by the new U.S. government under Trump.
It's quite amazing. I think it's also noteworthy about the role of U.S. border guards now. And there's some incoming legislation in Canada that would allow U.S. border guards to detain Canadians traveling to the country and prevent them from coming into the country, and even interrogate them rather aggressively.
Oh, it's incredible, this law that the Minister of National Security Goodale is proposing, ceding national sovereignty to American customs agents, giving them the power to detain and even strip search Canadians on Canadian soil. I mean, what could perhaps illustrate better in pretty graphic terms how far this Canadian government is preparing to go to accommodate itself to the U.S. government?
There was a major cabinet shuffle in Ottawa on the eve of Trump's inauguration. Notably, the shuffle saw Ukrainian, Canadian, and a relative newcomer, Chrystia Freeland. She was also a former trade minister, replacing Stéphane Dion, who was a long-serving Liberal cabinet minister, as the new foreign affairs minister, a very prestigious post. I was wondering if you see that move as connected in any way with the incoming Trump presidency and what direction this might take Canada's foreign policy.
You know, that move was and remains a bit of a mystery. I think what's simply involved is you have a combination of Chrystia Freeland's own personal ambitions to rise up the corporate and political ladder, clashing with Stéphane Dion, the ousted foreign minister. I think that's the main thing that's taken place. For however this was done, she convinced Trudeau in the inner circle that she would be better placed as a foreign minister. I know, of course, there was speculation about perhaps some friction or disagreement with respect to policy to Russia, because Dion, in the year and a couple of months that he was foreign minister, he was speaking out of both sides of his mouth on the issue of relations with Russia. That is, he said on the one hand, you know, we have to maintain a certain level of dialogue and even cooperation with Russia. And he cited specifically Arctic cooperation, which is actually a no-brainer. I mean, are the countries of the Arctic going to stop cooperating with it? I mean, that's just not going to work on any level. But he did voice that. And then he kind of, you know, he just voiced a few reservations about the calls from the extreme right in the Ukrainian diaspora. Here, there should be no relations with Russia and, you know, everything should go from bad to worse. So, you know, that was Dion's pronouncement. But on the other side of his mouth, Dion was continuing with Canada's military participation in the intervention in Ukraine, the ongoing sanctions against Russia and Crimea. In fact, Dion brought in some additional sanctions measures compared to the Harper regime before him. So I don't think there was a, I don't think that this was a substantive issue. That is, I don't think that the extreme right in Canada, with whom Freeland herself is very closely associated, saw Dion as kind of an unreliable foreign minister and so on. I think that that was maybe a small part of it, but I think the bigger story there is one that we don't know and didn't have a lot to do with Canada-Russia relations. That's my best guess, and it's only one observer's best guess.
Okay, that's fair enough. But, I mean, you talked about perhaps a less hostile approach on the part of Dion towards Russia. And, I mean, this seems to be the big hit on Trump. I mean, I'm just saying that, like, is there any solace? I mean, for all of the legitimate grievances people have about Trump, is there any solace in the fact that he has called for better relations with Russia versus the more confrontational rhetoric we've heard from Democrats like Obama and Clinton?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a really important question and a really important issue to think about, because I have been a bit of a lone wolf on this, if I could say, from the get-go. I never believed for a moment that under Donald Trump we would see a different policy that towards Russia and the rest of the world, that is a less aggressive policy. I just didn't believe it. And I also, I looked and read closely at Trump, what Trump himself was saying. And, you know, it was a few off-the-cuff remarks. People said, what's your attitude to Russia? He said, well, you know, why don't we get along? What's wrong with that? These sorts of things. Well, I mean, all that has been, I think, put to rest, certainly as of the speech to Congress a couple of days ago. But, you know, and I think it was there before, but it's certainly been put to rest now. Trump is, you know, just declaring that the U.S. will embark on the biggest military buildup in its history, including a further buildup of its nuclear arsenal. Trump, you know, Trump claims that the U.S. has lost some of its nuclear hegemony compared to Russia in past years and decades, which I don't think is true. But in any event, it was actually the Obama administration that began a multi-billion, I think it's even a trillion-dollar renewal or upgrading, if you could say, horrible term to think about, of the nuclear arsenal. And, you know, Trump has not only endorsed that, but he's sort of gone further and sort of stepping up the rhetoric on a new nuclear arms race with Russia. So, I mean, that's the substantive Trump. The few phrases that were tossed out here and there during the election campaign and even after his election, to me, never counted for very much. What counts is what the declared purpose of the Trump regime's use of the U.S. military is, and it's just, you know, there's little doubt left. And in fact, most of the observers who have kind of, you know, accepted the idea that maybe with Trump we were going to see a less aggressive foreign policy are conceding the point that actually we're headed quite possibly to something worse. Well, I don't want to say worse, because what could be worse than the Democrats? But, you know, we're headed towards something equally bad as to what we would have seen with Hillary Clinton as president. I felt this all along, and I feel it even more so today. And so, again, this is where we come back to the issue of Canada. Because if on two key issues, foreign policy and resource extraction, the governments of the United States and Canada are exactly in lockstep with one another. And this is not a question of Canada sort of being even pressured to do this. They see eye to eye on foreign policy in Ukraine, in Syria. Well, Canada is not so involved in Asia with the threats against China, but you know, you just see such a clear commonality of purpose in the foreign policies of the two governments. And so, you know, I think for Canadians, that should be a huge warning sign to kind of open our eyes as to what we have in power in Ottawa. This is a right-wing government in Ottawa that's prepared to coexist with the Trump administration and, in fact, already coexists on key policy issues.
You just published an article on newcoldwar.org, which reported on the decision by the Swedish government to reinvoke conscription, citing the Russian threat, as they call it. This seems to be a further illustration that the Russian threat narrative is not only reshaping U.S. politics, but politics in other countries as well. How do you see the new Cold War rhetoric reshaping Canada, and who benefits from that reshaping?
Well, the military-industrial complex benefits this heightened conflict with Russia, although it's not a simple matter of people making money off selling arms. This is a long-standing policy of the United States and the NATO military alliance to weaken, if not divide and conquer, the Soviet Union, then become the Russian Federation. This is why I think the view that, you know, Trump was going to bring about a change in this policy just didn't match up. You know, the U.S. government is not going to overthrow 70 years of anti-Russia, anti-Soviet policy because somebody gets elected and thinks maybe that's a good idea to change the policy. This is such a deeply rooted policy, which isn't just about the military-industrial complex making money off selling arms. It's about them controlling the world. And in today's world, countries that are truly independent, which include Russia, which include China, which I think now you could say includes Iran, Syria. This is a very troubling development for not just the United States, but its allies. Mm-hmm. And this is what they're determined to stamp out. I think this is why we've seen the escalation of the rhetoric and the build-up, the sanctions against Russia since the conflict in Ukraine 3 years ago, because they fear that they're losing this tight control that they had over the world. They fear rising powers, good or bad, of Russia, China, and others. And then, you know, getting to your question about Sweden, well, you know, boy, here's a lesson for Canadians. Here's a country like Canada, that is Sweden, like Canada, has a reputation as a less aggressive power, as a kind of peace-friendly country. I mean, Sweden has much stronger credentials on that score than Canada ever did. And yet, look what's happening in Sweden, introducing military conscription and then just putting the country into a panic stage. I mean, you have to read the Swedish press. I don't read Swedish, but you read the English language press that's published in Sweden. You know, you'd think Russia is going to invade Sweden tomorrow. This is the atmosphere they're creating. And I think this is a very deliberate part of the conscription policy. Maybe they need conscription, as the Swedish government leaders are saying, in order to keep their military kind of at a higher level of personnel and so forth, of capacity. But I think there's a very big propaganda kind of initiative happening here, which is the Swedish government wants to scare its population, and it wants to scare all the people of the world that look to Sweden as a kind of a peace-loving country into believing that there is an immediate Russian threat against Sweden and against anybody else potentially in the world. This is what this conscription decision is about, and I think it bears a lot of study, in particular by Canadians, because we have so much similarity in the international image of the governments of Canada and Sweden. And clearly in neither country do we have governments that have any interest in peace. And there's simply no, there's, I mean, this has already been argument, you know, without argument, the case in Canada. But now even in Sweden, even in so-called peace-loving Sweden, we see, you know, aggressive. And I should even note, this, the government that's undertaken this decision in Sweden is a soft left government. It's a coalition government of the Social Democratic Party and the Green Party, if you can believe it. So this is a bad omen, very bad omen. And you know, the moment I saw the news this morning, I said, oh my God, people have to know about this. And I hope that people will indeed look at this decision by Sweden very closely and really think through, you know, what this means in the current context and dynamic of the new Cold War.
Well, on that rather somber note, I do want to thank you, Roger Ennis, for coming on the show and taking the time to share your views with us. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been speaking with writer, socialist, and trade union activist Roger Ennis. He is an editor and frequent contributor to the independent news site newcoldwar.org. Some of his articles can also be found on the site rogerannis.com. Some observers believe, especially in the wake of President Trump's speech to Congress, that the press is beginning to normalize Trump, even in the face of a disturbing trajectory his presidency has taken since Inauguration Day. One of those observers is Barry Zwicker. Barry is a Toronto-based media critic with decades of experience as a print and broadcast journalist. He returns to the Global Research NewsHour with some of his thoughts. Good to hear from you again, Barry.
Well, good to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Michael.
I'm going to read to you a quote from Obama partisan and Trump critic Van Jones in reference to Trump's speech before Congress, particularly referencing a salute to the bravery of an American Navy SEAL killed during a recent raid in Yemen. Van Jones said, and I quote, "For people who have been hoping that maybe he would remain a divisive cartoon, which he often finds a way to do, they should begin to become a little bit worried tonight, because that thing you just saw him do, if he finds a way to do that over and over again, he's going to be there for 8 years. Now, there was a lot that he said in that speech that was counterfactual, that was not right, that I oppose and will oppose. But he did something tonight that you cannot take away from him. He became President of the United States," unquote. The sentiment seemed to echo throughout the mainstream media. You saw the president's speech in its entirety. What did you take away from it?
One thing that we have to realize is that we don't have time, you and I, in this brief conversation this morning, to really go as long and deep and wide in any critique of the mainstream media's coverage of Trumpism that we really should do. But in respect of that speech in the Congress and the introduction of the Special Forces widow, I noticed that too when my wife and I were watching. And I've been looking at a little bit of the media coverage since Tuesday's address, too. And maybe these specifics that I intend to bring up would reflect that larger picture that would be for listeners to decide. Now, first, the speech. I found it just painful to watch the Republican lawmakers' reaction to introducing that widow of the U.S. Chief Special Warfare Operator. You know, that's his job description, which means killer in Yemen. And let's be frank, he was a killer. He went to kill, but he got killed. But the Republican-trained SEALs wore out their flippers in a ridiculously drawn-out two-minute paroxysm of self-righteous uber-patriotism. I mean, I'd seen these speeches before, but this had to be the lowest point I'd ever seen You know, you really get tired of seeing those Republicans, especially, standing up and applauding. But I saw nothing of this sickeningly memorable moment in the coverage following that I saw. Anyway, the Van Jones quote was new to me. And I'm talking specifically about the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and CBC Television News and Current Affairs, which I follow all three really closely. I saw nothing about that moment in those three media outlets. And it reminded me again of the incredible power of omission, which is arguably the most potent aspect of political speeches and of media coverage of anything. And now here's what Trump did not address last Tuesday. Not a word about Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Not a word about the huge gap between the very rich and everyone else, which is the worst since 1920. Not a word about corruption of campaign finance rules, which have been painfully obvious to millions of us and has been for years. Not a word about voter suppression, not a word about climate change, not a word about how to fix the broken criminal justice system in the USA, which holds more people in prison than any other country on earth. Not a word about the high cost or the lowering of tuition fees for college and university students. Not a word about the U.S. Treasury losing $100 million a year because of offshore tax havens. Not a word about the cost of prescription drugs. Now, that's just a partial list of what was left out of that speech. Now, here's an interesting, closely related thing. Bernie Sanders, immediately following Trump's speech, took to YouTube and made a brilliant critique of it. The full video runs about 14 minutes, and I viewed that. I found it. Got 2 million plus views. And in it, Sanders focuses on the omissions I've just mentioned. Now, there are five YouTube versions of what he said, one of which is an AP clip that runs a minute 40. Now, how much and how well did the mainstream report Sanders' critique? And it was brilliant, substantial, coherent, and well-expressed. I searched the Globe, print and online. Bernie Sanders' name has not been mentioned in the Globe since February 26th. Not a word. On the CBC, my wife and I did not see an instant of Sanders while we were viewing. I admit I may have missed a clip of him, if such was used, but I can find nothing on the CBC website by searching under the headings radio, TV, news, opinion, or politics. In the Star, nothing in print. But interestingly, on the Star's website is that AP 140 clip. But the sound will not work for me, no matter what I try. This is unusual, what can I say? So, the mainstream media failed regarding the significant comments of Bernie Sanders about this speech, even failed in the hoariest, bare requirement of doing he said, she said. But there's a plus side. Okay, I'm getting really negative here. On the plus side are two examples from the coverage of Tuesday's address and other stuff since that I would score highly. First, there was Daniel Dale. Now, Daniel Dale is the Washington bureau chief of the Toronto Star. At the top of Thursday's Toronto Star, he has gotten the top billing under a headline, "Trump's Immigration Stance Raises Alarm." Now, why is this special? It is special because Daniel Dale, right off the top of his piece, brings in historical parallels to Hitler. It starts off, Claudia Kuhns, K-O-O-N-Z, a historian at Duke University, wrote a book about how the Nazis prepared Germans to accept genocide. One of their tactics was portraying average Jews, who were overwhelmingly law-abiding, as a menace to society. In the 1930s, for example, a Nazi newspaper published a weekly list of the alleged crimes of Jews. So what did Trump do? In January, Trump ordered his government to publish a weekly list of crimes committed by illegal immigrants who are overwhelmingly law-abiding in most of the country's big cities. So the thing is that it was only in the Toronto Star that I saw coverage of that speech and that particular part of the speech, which was not what we would call ahistorical. In other words, it drew a historical parallel. Mm. Well, more could be said about that, but the second specific point I'd like to bring up is Leah McLaren's column in the Globe and Mail this morning. Now, she quotes extensively from a think piece published by The Guardian in the UK, and oddly, she doesn't use the name of the author, who is Carol Cadwallader. She's Welsh. She's a former Daily Telegraph journalist. She now contributes features and columns to The Observer, and then The Guardian picked her up. Now, in this piece that Leah McLaren is simply quoting, it's not investigative journalism in one sense, because McLaren is just quoting The Guardian piece that Cadwallader did. But Cadwallader did the investigative journalism. And what she looks into is the connections between Trump and his single largest donor, who contributed $13.5 million to Trump's campaign. And that is a guy named Robert Mercer, a hedge fund billionaire. And Mercer specializes in computer analytics. And he's very interested in mass propaganda via social media algorithms. And there's a lot of really valuable stuff in this relatively long column by Leah McLaren. But I would just mention a couple of quotes that McLaren has chosen from Cadwallader's piece toward the end.
Mm.
And she quotes Professor Jonathan Rust, director of Cambridge University's Center for Psychometrics, and he spoke to The Guardian. And he said, what Mercer is doing, and obviously Trump has bought into it and is deeply involved in it, along with Steve Bannon, he said, it's nothing short of mass brainwashing. This is a direct quote, and it's happening. The danger of not having regulation around the sort of data you can get from Facebook and elsewhere is clear. With this, a computer can actually do psychology. It can predict and potentially control human behavior. It's not exaggeration to say that minds can be changed. Behavior can be predicted and controlled. People don't know it's happening to them. Their attitudes are being changed behind their backs. Now, this is the kind of information that, in my opinion, the media should be dealing in much, much more than they do. And I have long been a person who said that we have to pay attention to neurobiology and neuropsychology and neurophysiology. And indeed, I practically shouted yay out loud when I read Leah McLaren's second paragraph. She said, this idea that human biases in perception can create an illogical and highly subjective state of, quote, reality, unquote, has been well explored in the fields of neuroscience, psychology, and behavioral economics. And then she quotes a book title. So anyway, you have to find some rays of light, shall we say, in the mainstream media coverage, but they're too few and far between. That would be my conclusion.
Okay. Well, Barry, I really want to thank you for giving us that assessment, and we look forward to having you on again.
Thanks so much, Michael.
So we've been speaking with Barry Zwicker. He is a retired journalist and also a prominent media critic. You can catch more of his articles if you go to the website truthandshadows.wordpress.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.